All right, then, we've got the second section of the text of Genesis chapter 25 tonight. We are building on the foundation of some of the earlier things we've discussed. A couple of tie-ins. Remember, this is in the transition of the patriarchal steps of leadership for the chosen people of what will become Israel. So we're shifting now from Abraham. Both Abraham and Sarah are now off of the focus point of our look into their lives, and now we've moved forward into the next generation. It's going to bring a next step, if you will, in God's working with this group of His creation. It has a specific benefit to you and I because it's part of the pathway for which the seed, which is Christ, will come. As we've highlighted a couple times, we'll do so again. The marital and family messes that are these families are very much, on the one hand, different than what you and I know, in part because of the testimony of Christ. When Christ comes and then declares in passages like Matthew chapter 19, Mark chapter 9, very clear expectations for marital relationships, it shifts the focus from whatever was accommodated both before the law and under the old law to a clear one man, one woman standard. That's different than what we see all of these families. The other thing to remember, though, is that even though that standard now is much more understandable in the teaching of Christ, we still deal with families that have a lot of the same kind of complications. We just don't often refer to them with the same terminology. We use stepchildren. We use other terminology to talk about relationships as first wife, second wife, third wife, to try to define some of these things. And so just keep that in mind, that some of the challenges of understanding are terminology-based rather than relationship-based. Secondly, again, like I pointed out the first, we still have to remember, though, that we are not under the law of Moses. We're not living in the time before the law was codified. We're living under the law of Christ. And so when we're figuring out what we need to do about our marital relationships, our family relationships, we say, what did Christ teach us? What did Christ's apostles teach us? And we make application from there. But we will learn a whole lot from these Old Testament events. Even sometimes we learn to say, I don't know. And that's a powerful thing about some of the stuff that happens. Why did that happen? I really don't know, because God didn't tell us. And that's not an unfortunate answer. It's a practical one. There's large segments of the people of God's lives that are completely darkened to us. Abraham lived about 140 years, roughly, if I remember my math just right. And we have a few pages of his life. So just there's a whole lot I don't know for all of those individuals there. So moving into the 25th chapter, and we're going to be picking up unless we have some great questions. And by the way, I said it again. I said it on Sunday. I'll say it again now. I really do like it when everyone asks questions and participates in the Bible class. And so if you've got stuff that you want to bring up, please do so. There is no question that shouldn't be asked. And if you can't find a way to do so comfortably in the big group, just come to me privately. Come to one of the other men, and I'm sure we'll be happy to sit down and talk about it. Because we should be digging in, learning, and asking questions. That's the point of the Bible class, is to fill in the gaps of what we don't know. So in this section of text, we've got a couple of things already kind of broken out for us that we've seen already in walking this way. And now we move into Jacob and Esau. And there is a couple of aspects of their relationship that are going to have permanent ramifications for every time we see their descendants interacting. The idea of the heel grabber and the swapping of order, the character traits you see within them, the impatience of Esau, I'm going to die. You know, you see this idea of, if I don't eat right now, it's ending. And also the application that comes in the New Testament from these events. And just to draw the facts together to see this bigger picture again, Esau's out hunting in the field. He's unsuccessful. Comes back. And what is it that his brother's cooking up? And see, is it a really great feast? Like just the best meal produced ever? It's just sort of pottage, mess of pottage, just a little stew, you know, just a leafy stew. So from a guy who likes to eat meat, because that's who he is, he tosses it all aside for just a tiny little thing. Now, there's two things that come up in the New Testament record of this that are important. It describes Esau as being profane and immoral. That his life, in essence, as a big picture, was someone who was open to doing whatever and not religious. When it says profane, it means he was really far away from anything to do with God whatsoever by the time we're looking back on him. And that describes his behavior. Because there's a step he could have chosen to take that could have solved this problem. And it doesn't even involve his brother. He didn't need necessarily the help of his brother to solve his problem. His problem could have solved by asking for someone else's help. He could have gone to the father. Because he still has a place of preeminence and prominence right now. He still has a segment of blessings right now that come through his earthly father, but stem from the promise from his heavenly father. He could have gone there. Could have gone to God, offered up a prayer, and patiently waited for God's solution. But he's defined as being profane, away from God altogether. That kind of drives why you see him making this decision. God's not part of his decision process at all. Furthermore, when it talks about his immorality, it's talking about his loose morals, both sexually and personally. That he was open to being way outside God's expectations. Because he just didn't care. That helps us kind of understand a little bit about why he makes certain choices. But it doesn't wash away then the other side of the relationship. Jacob, the heel grabber, the supplanter, the one who took the place. These two brothers here then define their relationship on the basis of this inability to get along. And then we also highlighted again Sunday how that also was seen in their parents. Because the parents, they pick their favorites. They have their one side, other side. And they eventually would play them off of each other. Not a healthy model. Not a healthy standard for that relationship whatsoever. And so the story moves forward. And we're going to pick up now in verse 27. And Les, would you read that for us? Genesis chapter 25, verses 27 through 34.
When the boy grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter and man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate it of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I'm exhausted." Therefore his name was called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I am about to die, but what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and a little stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright.
One thing you might want to underline or circle or make note of in your Bible is that one phrase, despised. What was his right by birth? That's a birthright. What was he in store to gain? What should he have received?
Everything. Inherent most of his father's wealth.
Right, everything. He was going to be, in essence, the leader of whatever would be in the future of the people. And he so despised that thought, so little of it, just to toss it aside. Especially when you consider our picture. What kind of value does the descendancy of Abraham have? Like, if you thought about all that Abraham had, what would that be? What is Abraham known for as being? Well, that's his great estate. You know, that was his great work. Well, the father of many nations. That was part of the fulfillment of God's plan.
the land, his own great people. Well, there's one thing that is mentioned a couple times in the New Testament that is really the legacy of Abraham and clarity.
Seed.
Well, his seed in Christ, that's seen in his own faithfulness as well. Well, you want to be Abraham's children? Be part of his legacy? Well, then believe like he did. So there's a great mental tie-in that helps us kind of remember a whole lot about this when you think about what Esau really despised. That birthright would have tied him into the legacy of being a person whom God then uses again and again as an illustration of faithfulness. And Esau didn't want any of it. No, I can do my own better. Because he had obviously had a mindset that he didn't need it. Didn't want it, didn't need it at all. Didn't need the faith that Abraham had. Didn't need any of the blessing that would come through his father. Just throw it all away. And so that really, that phrase there, despised, is again equivalent to what I mentioned as well earlier, profaned. Because it's not worth anything to him. And so it's just a good way to remember how much it was he was throwing away there. It wasn't just about the earthly things. He also tossed aside all the spiritual things too. All the blessings that would come through his family. Which then makes this story, which seems already pretty tragic as it is, because you've already reached a point where the relationship with these two brothers is so bad, this is how they treat each other. But now it's even worse. And yet, God is able to work through things to bring about opportunities for the blessing of the all nations through some of these particular families and some of the messages that they would make through that journey, if you will. Any questions about that small section? I know we covered it kind of in an overview form, and then we broke down in the text. All right. It gives us a chance to move forward to chapter 26 tonight. So we'll go ahead and scoot forward there in the text to the 26th chapter. One of the things we remember as we're turning there, Edom becomes an illustration in the Old Testament that's equivalent to the idea of maybe the more familiar two towns or cities we know of, Sodom and Gomorrah. So if we say Sodom and Gomorrah, we know that's a wicked place. Well, for the minor prophets, for the work of the prophets altogether, they often use the illustration of Esau's people, Edom, as an illustration of wickedness. And it begins here at this point. So that's another kind of tie-in to help us see some of these details. So the 26th chapter, as we move forward, this begins maybe the initial highlights, if you will, of what will be a long-standing struggle for Israel. Israel, as it travels and sojourns back and forth, both pre-captivity, post-captivity, and then a couple more captivities down the road as they are being chastised by God versus their captivity and preparation in Egypt, are going to struggle with the relationship to the Philistines. It's going to be a constant thorn that will really never go away. Even in the time of Christ, the impact of these challenged relationships are still there. We don't always notice it because they don't refer to every single nation as Philistines in the New Testament. That's kind of a no longer a geographical term that's used. But the Gentile nations that surround Israel, including all of the various Roman groups, and well, they're all connected in some way to the regions of the same Philistine zones, if you will. So the Philistines were there. They just weren't always referred to as Philistines per se. But here it is, beginning once again there in chapter 26, verse 1. It says, "Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, and the Lord appeared to him and said, 'Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands,
and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. And I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and give your descendants all the lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So Isaac lived in Gerar. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, "She is my sister." For he was afraid to say my wife, thinking, "The men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful." And it came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, behold, Isaac was caressing his wife, Rebekah. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, certainly she is your wife. How then did you say, 'She is my sister'?" And Isaac said to him, "Because I said, 'Lest I die on account of her.'" And Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, "He who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." One of the quick points you can recognize is, where do you think maybe this idea of protecting himself by calling his wife his sister came from?
His dad.
It's a reminder that we sometimes make fun of, that kids will say whatever their parents say. So be careful what you say from your kids, because they're going to repeat it. Well, in a more practical sense, that's actually how everybody learns. Everyone learns through the same modeling behavior. In the Bible, we kind of contextualize it and we make some good grouping terminology. We say we might learn by a command. Someone tells us to do something. But we also might learn by following an example. It means we see someone else do something and we do the same thing. Well, generally, when we're talking about those things, we're talking about good things, right? Hopefully that's our idea. When we read the Bible, look for good things, we want to repeat the good things. Well, the Bible also shows us that people do the exact same thing to learn bad behavior. The bad behavior could be someone telling them to do bad things. Or in this case, it certainly looks like they're just repeating bad decisions. The other oddity is the response of the immoral people, as we might sometimes look at them around them, were actually what we would expect the moral people to do on the first thing. Because you should have just told us that this was your wife. You should have been open with us about it, because of your decision, you put us at risk. You put our morality. You would have brought guilt upon us because you didn't tell us the truth. You only told us a little bit of the truth. It was a family relationship, and he could have accommodatively said, "She's my sister." Because that term would have been okay as being part of the big family group. So they were related close enough to be referred to in that context at that time. But their relationship was much closer than that. And so it's another interesting parallel that we see there, is that at times the decisions of those who were the immoral people around God's people were the better choice. The more at least appropriate moral choice. And so it's a powerful reminder to kind of catch both edges of that, both the modeled behavior in the son they learn from the father, and yet at times the correction we need comes from a source we least expected it. You don't expect correction to come in that regard, and yet it did. And the accommodation that's made at this end of the section is basically a broad warning and says, no one's going to touch her. And in fact, we're going to make sure that nobody violates this. We don't know all the other parts of the reasons as to why they would be so concerned with guilt, what their own moral standards were, and all of that other factors. But we do know the outcome was that his family should have then been protected against any kind of harm or fear that he had, that the beauty of his wife would be some level of difficulty for them. Goes on, and remember back in the early part of the text we read in verses 1 through 7 or so, that God promised a blessing upon them It says, now Isaac sowed in the land and reaped in the same year 100-fold. And the Lord blessed him. And the man became rich and continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. For he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envied him. Now all the wells which his father's servants had dug up, had dug in the days of Abraham his father, the Philistines stopped up by filling them with earth. Then Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you are too powerful for us. And Isaac departed from there and camped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. And so now you have the turn of the events. Well, everything's fine, because you're no threat to us in essence. But we see the turn. But now that God has blessed him, both financially and with growth in his possessions, well, now envy turns to the boot. Now, they're obviously envious of his success. They might not even understand why he's being so successful, but they do know they don't want him around anymore. And so he's being pushed away from there and away from them. This really begins, again, that starting phases of an ongoing conflict between the two peoples. Any questions over this section as we overview? Norris?
I don't say if you're going back with Isaac or Rebecca. I don't know if he wondered when Abraham did that with Sarah, but he wondered was that something that they just did because of fear? That, you know, somebody might see his wife beautiful and might want him, and they say, well, this is my sister, which in the case it was my sister.
Well, the thing to kind of connect to is family stories don't die. They kind of stay around. And the morality that makes choices is what's passed on. He learned that choice model from somewhere. And the person that he would have learned it one would have been his own people, his own family. The application of it is so parallel that you just have to stop and say, same thing. Same decision process. Same outcome. You know, where they're caught, where it's become obvious that they lied. And there's no other way to kind of soften that edge. It was rebellion, it was improper across the board. Anyone else? I thought I may have saw another hand. All right, so verse 23. Then he went up from there to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared to him in this. The same night and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. Now again, you see here an introduction to an event which becomes more and more rare. In Genesis, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, there's close proximity between God and his creation. Genesis 4 and forward, the amount of closeness that an individual or a group of people have with God starts spreading out. There's distance that takes place. Where the patriarchs now are really the primary conduit for conversation with God. And then as we move into the nation of Israel, it then funnels through a smaller amount. Maybe one of the high priests, maybe a special prophet, maybe a high priest who's in a prophetic role, maybe a king. But there's less and less direct contact between God and his creation as we move forward. You also notice this. If you look at some of these early conversations with God, there's not as much of a fear of space, if you will, where the people who are approaching God are respecting his space. Where you see like Isaiah, like Hezekiah, like Jeremiah, when they're talking about the way in which they first interact with Jehovah, it's out of a great sense of awe and reverence. You see it some with Moses, particularly as he gets really close to God on the mountain. But here, these conversations are short, quiet. There's not a lot of thunder involved, if you will. You don't have the big explosive events that take place in some of those greater prophetic scenes. But there's less of it. There's less direct contact. Particularly as you get to the end of the prophets. And then we go into what we refer to as the period of silence, where God is not really having his prophets out to work. And then we have the arrival of John the Immerser, John the prophet, John the speaker, John the last prophet of the Old Testament. And so it's kind of interesting to see that kind of fade down. And so particularly as we move from Genesis and go into 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Samuel and Chronicles, you're going to see God speaking through a smaller and smaller people, a smaller and smaller window. But again, he restates and reiterates that same basic promise, the same promise that's going through Abraham, the same expectation, the same plan. Multiply your descendants. I'm going to be with you. You should not be afraid. That reminder of do not fear is a constant reminder of Jehovah. He constantly reminds his people, his nation, his servants, that there's no reason to be afraid. Even if they're all alone on a mountainside and they feel like there's no one left for them that's bowing their knee to God as well, God tells them, no, you're not alone. You weren't alone before, you're not alone now. And then Jesus reiterates that same phrase a lot as well. And he says he is with you, or he is with Isaac in this sense. This is also coming off of the end of this rejection of opportunity. When they left the lands of familiarity where Abraham had dug all those wells, now he has a large amount of responsibility, but no way to care for them. There's no more water for them because they've stopped them all off. So you can imagine the desperation growing to understand what's going on. And now God does what he does. He provides. He gives them opportunity, he gives encouragement, he gives reminder. And the well of oath is what they name this location. By the way, we'll see that in a little bit. It's really where the covenant is reconnected to. It's a covenant of great opportunity. Continuing down, we're going to pick up now in verse 26 to catch some of that. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with his advisor, Huzzath, and Phicol, the commander of his army. And Isaac said to them, why have you come to me since you hate me and have sent me away from you? And they said, we see plainly that the Lord has been with you. So we said, let there now be an oath between us, even between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you, that you will do us no harm, just as we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord. Now pause for a moment right there. Have they done nothing to him? Was this a fully accurate and true statement on their part? No. But it certainly sounds like we sent you away in peace. Yeah, except you cut off access to the water they needed to take care of all their holdings, and you were envious of them and you kicked them out. But hey, everything's good. So it's good to understand that there's a little more to that than the sweet sounding words of the politician, if you will, that's speaking. Then he made them a feast and they ate and drank. And in the morning they arose early and exchanged oaths. Then Isaac sent them away and they departed from him in peace. Now it came about on the same day that Isaac's servants came in and told him about the well which they had dug, and said to him, we have found water. So he called it Sheba. Therefore the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. And when Esau was 40 years old, it goes on, we'll catch that in a second. He's married the daughter of Beeri. So here we have a kind of a superficial relationship in some senses. Oh, you left us in peace. Nah, they left them in peace. But clearly it's not the same as it could have been. When they were together in the same field, sharing the same space, they were in close proximity to one another. But now with this level of separation, any kind of new things that come up, as it is and always will be, if you're not next to someone, you kind of forget how to relate to them. The relationship isn't as strong.
because you're not sharing as many things. Well, it's going to go downhill. It's going to get worse. There's going to be new challenges that come up. And this level of peace between Abimelech, between Isaac, between these two families is probably as good as it's going to get. It's not really going to ever be like that again. And Esau here on this section, this is just verses 34 and 35, is mentioned briefly for us. That Esau married a Hittite woman. Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah.
As we've highlighted before, that doesn't really change too much. The grief that's going on here is really going to continue and sustain itself when you think about the future for Jacob and Esau. But again, pause for a moment and make the application, because this is a great section of the text to do about. And think about how relationships today, again, are so much in the same place. I've had a couple of close friends over the years, and some not so close, that have decided to get married. And for various reasons, before the marriage took place, I took them aside, especially once I started preaching full time, and said, maybe this isn't the best choice. And I'll admit that sometimes my wording probably wasn't as wise as it could have been, especially in my youth. But sometimes you can kind of see that the direction someone's choosing to go isn't always the best choice. And for whatever reason, whenever a wedding takes place, people kind of put blinders on. Because weddings are generally what? Really happy occasions. And we just want everyone to be happy. And so we've gotten into this cycle where we've told ourselves, well, we can't tell someone that the future doesn't look bright. Well, here's a case where the Bible tells us the future wasn't bright. We learn about it afterwards in history. From the day of its recording here in this point in the text, it brought grief. And the wisdom of maturity should give us opportunities sometimes to tell someone, hey, slow down a little bit. Because there's consequences. Because I'm sure you and I know couples that before they got married, you could look at it and go, it doesn't look good. Maybe they should slow down. And did it happen kind of as you predicted? Are you a prophet or you've just lived long? And you've probably just lived long. Because emotional love often clouds actual logic. It just kind of creates, and that's just what it always, emotions always create clouds that obscure truth. The great parallel is just to think about how we sometimes think about Samson's choice in who to date and who to be around. I've seen a woman. She looks good to me. Go get her. By the way, that defines early male selection process. We have to grow up some before guys get a little more sense. Because early on, that's pretty much how we make our decisions. We grow up and mature, we leave that behind. So it's a good point of reminder for us to look at this case and say, okay, nothing's new. Just as Solomon wrote, nothing's new under the sun. Here it is playing it out again. The application point for us is to say, how do we not do this same thing? If we're going to learn, so I'm going to pause here and make some questions. By the way, in a couple of weeks, we'll start having some handouts that will have questions on them so that can help guide us over the course of the weeks to kind of help in our studies day to day. But how do we avoid this problem? Looking at the average age of our group here means that we either have children, maybe we have grandchildren, and we care about their choices. So here's the big question. How do we help our children, our grandchildren, maybe ourselves, not choose a wife like Esau does, like Samson does? Think about that before you answer. I've got some things typed up here for my side of the answer to it, but how do we avoid this? Because that's what we want to do. We don't want to just read it and say it was bad. We're going to say, how do we not do that? We're also going to say on the other end, how do we replicate the positive things take place? The faith of Abraham, the faith of Isaac, the faith of Jacob, in spite of all their, at times, very awful choices, they keep turning back to God. They keep turning back in His direction.
And so, teach them these stories. Teach them self-control from an early age, whether it's food or a toy or something that they have to have. And teach them, you know, you have to have self-control. And all along, you teach them these stories.
Yeah, we tell ourselves, and as a culture, our kids can learn so many things so much earlier than they used to. Kids right now, pretty much you can give a 5-year-old kid an iPad and they can go to town. And when I got a touch screen device, it took me quite a while to figure out where to touch and not to touch. But they just catch it right up. They can learn different languages quicker. Actually, most kids learn languages faster than adults do. Multiple languages. Mathematics. English. We drill them on them early. The spiritual matters have to be there early too, if we have opportunity. So we tell them self-control. We teach them about godliness, morality. We teach them about something that's really important. Choices have consequences. Now, the consequence may be small early in life, but they magnify later in life. So we teach them about those things. We also want to teach them to be listeners to people with wisdom. And here's a good parallel as it kind of happens in the segment. Just because someone has lived longer on the earth doesn't mean their age has also come with wisdom. Because sometimes, just because someone gives you some advice and they're older, they're actually telling you to do the wrong thing. So where does wisdom come from then? If it's not just about being older, who should these young folks be listening to? Jehovah first, for sure. And listen for people who are telling you that God said, and here's where He said it. You know, God said it right here. He said that this is really important. And what's really important? Well, who you're going to marry in our context is really important. Because He talks about who you can't marry. Who you ought not to marry. Whether you can marry or not. God talks about that too. He talks about what marriage is. He talks about what a family is. So these are all subjects that are perfectly okay to teach from the beginning. Certainly you might want to use some verbal modesty for some of the stories. That means you're careful with your word choices. Because some of these stories include some pretty awful things. But you've got to be willing to give them the warning so they know how to avoid it. Just like we do with everything else in life. We teach them so they don't get in trouble. We teach them that here are the laws. Don't break the laws because there are consequences. So it's a good kind of a threshold of reminder to say these stories can be taught early as well because we don't want to see that happen. But not every person we interact with, we have the privilege of interacting with them when they're young. Sometimes we might not get them into our lives until we're 18. And they're 18. They're friends of ours. Or maybe we're in the grandparent relationship. Or maybe we've just met them and they're a new brother or sister in Christ and they're in their 20s and we're in our 50s. Guess what? You can still do the same thing. You go to that same 18-year-old, that same 20-year-old, and you tell them the stories of God. You say, this is what happens if you do that. And you can also say, and I saw it happen this way. And you'll see it happen this way. And you can prepare them for the journey that's going to happen as well. Because they need to hear it too. There's an interesting thing, and I talked about it some Sunday, when it comes to parents and children, that you know most parents know a whole lot, and then they don't know much, and they know a whole lot again. But those young people who are ignoring their parents, do they stop learning? Do they stop needing advice? You know what they actually need it from? The other adults in their lives. Trusted folks, maybe elders within the body of Christ, maybe other faithful members of faithful Christians in the local community. They will actually listen to them when mom and dad aren't around. And that's an opportunity for you and I to help somebody else. But remember, what you're trying to teach them
because of what we've already kind of mentioned. God said it. Here's where it said it. And here's why it's important. So you're directing it back to the same source. That level of moral consistency will then be seen in everything that they do. And hopefully then we won't have a situation where we have these cycles of bad behavior where you get father and son replicating the same immoral choices as they leave their families because that new pathway is being picked. Another thing to point out is that at least in this particular case, Esau isn't highlighted as being the source of grief. It's the two women. They were the source of much grief. Now, it doesn't go into why, but we do know a couple of things that's different about this. Abraham and Isaac, where did their wives come from?
Close family.
Native land.
Yeah, close family that also had a close connection to God through that same family line. Esau's wives, not following that same plan. So it gives us a hint. It doesn't outright tell us at this point what their spirituality was like, but we do know what Esau's was like. He didn't care. So it did not matter to him. Again, this hints at the perennial challenge of bringing new people into the family. You know, there's a lot of folks who make jokes about mother-in-law, daughter-in-law relationships. Here in this particular case, there's no joking matter. It really was an awful relationship. We just don't have all the details, and it's probably better off that way. Probably better that we don't know. My thing says 7:45. Is that our cutoff time? Well, that clock over there says 7:43, I think. So which clock are we going to go by, Steve? You get to call it. You got the button, man. You're halfway in charge. Let's call it right there so we can finish at the end of chapter 26 and we won't enter into chapter 27. So we'll just hiatus at this point in the text. We'll pick up Sunday morning then walking into the 27th chapter of Genesis. I want to encourage you to continue to read through Genesis as much as you can. The more you read through it, the more likely it is you'll catch the connecting details through each of these segments of the history of God's people. Thanks, everybody.